What is global warming? How will it affect you? What can be done about it? These are among the important questions we will explore with our special guest, veteran journalist and author Ross Gelbspan. A longtime reporter and editor with the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, Mr. Gelbspan began focusing on the issue of climate change over 10 years ago. He has written two books on the subject, The Heat Is On and Boiling Point. In his books, Mr. Gelbspan reports on the growing body of scientific research on global warming, as well as the debate over what can or should be done about it. In addition, Mr. Gelbspan created a website, heatisonline.org, where he reports on the latest developments in global warming. Mr. Gelbspan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for giving the subject the airtime. I very much appreciate it.
Well, global warming, what is it? What causes it?
It's actually fairly simple. It is that when we burn coal and oil and other carbon fuels, those are really a natural gas to a lesser extent, they release carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide traps in heat so that, and there are some other greenhouse gases too, but carbon dioxide is by far the predominant one. And it traps in heat that otherwise would escape back into space. So as human beings have been industrializing, that's really since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in this country, we've had a big buildup in the amount of carbon dioxide. So, for example, for 10,000 years, the amount was steady at about 280 parts per million. It is now up to about 380 parts per million. And the first consequence of that is that it's trapping more heat in, it's raising the planet's temperature, and it's also doing lots of other things that we'll explore later in the program. But that simply is the basis of global warming.
What countries are the primary producers of the greenhouse gases?
The U.S. is by far the largest. The U.S., with about 5% of the world's population, generates about a quarter of the world's carbon emissions. But we will be overtaken very soon by India and China in particular, as they also industrialize, unless they really go to different energy sources, which they would love to do. But in the meantime, the U.S. is really the primary one. One thing that's very interesting to note is that the U.S. economy is also relatively inefficient, so that, for example, per capita, the U.S. actually emits not quite, but almost twice as much as the average European does. And we live at about the same kind of living standards as middle-class Europeans in Western Europe. So they've actually learned how to make their economies much more energy efficient.
What are the principal sources within the industrialized countries of the greenhouse gases?
In the U.S., it comes about equally one-third from electricity generation, most of which comes from coal, a very small percentage from nuclear, which is greenhouse friendly. One-third comes from transportation, and one-third comes from heating and cooling of homes and also normal industrial energy use. So it really breaks down into almost equal thirds. Those proportions can change in other countries, especially countries that are a bit smaller than the U.S. and don't have as long distances for transportation. But that's basically the way it breaks down in the industrial world.
And how does the production of CO2 by industry relate to plants and its ability to absorb CO2?
Well, it's very interesting. Let me step back for one second, Ken, if I can. The science tells us that we need to worldwide reduce our emissions by about 70%. And the Earth's trees and plants can absorb about 15% of that 70%. However, what happens with the plants is they're finding that CO2 has interesting effects. It acts in the early period as a fertilizer. So when plants are subjected to more concentrated CO2 input, they actually grow very fast. It increases their growth. But what happens is after a short time, these plants become very sickly. They become overstressed. They grow too fast. They actually become weakened and much more subject to insect diseases and other kinds of plant diseases, and their productivity falls way off. So, for example, they did a very interesting experiment with caterpillars, and they were feeding them some normal plants that they normally eat. And then they were feeding them some plants that were sort of force-fed with carbon dioxide, and the caterpillars ate about twice as much of the carbon dioxide-enhanced plants because they were much less nutritious, and they had much less of the kind of nutrients that the caterpillars want. So the impact on plants in the near term is a good one. It causes faster growth, but then it really ends up overstressing the plants and in the longer run makes them weaker and more vulnerable.
Now, you mentioned the necessity to reduce the fossil fuel use by 70%, and I believe that came out of the work of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Could you talk about the research of the IPCC?
Absolutely. This is very important. This began in 1988, which was a very important year. And that's the year that the UN began to set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Coincidentally, it's the same year that one of America's leading climate scientists, a man named Jim Hansen, who works for NASA, went before Congress and said global warming is at hand. And what the IPCC is, this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it's essentially a body of about 300 scientists from about 100 countries, and they review the work of more than 2,000 scientists from all over the world every year. And they put out every 4 or 5 years what are called assessments of the state of the climate. So they came out with a major assessment in 1995 in which they determined absolutely that it's human activities in the form of our coal and oil burning that is changing the chemistry of the atmosphere and is changing the temperature of the planet. And they came out with another report in 2001 in which they were very surprised that global warming is progressing much more rapidly than they had thought before and that the impacts are becoming much more heavy than they were before. So basically, that is this panel of more than 2,000 scientists. And what's important to understand is, especially when you hear from the naysayers, is that this is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. This is about as close to truth as we can get. So their findings are meticulously scrutinized. I happen to know a bunch of these scientists myself, and they love to shoot each other down. They have large egos. They want to find fault in other people's work. So for someone's findings to survive the peer review process, it has to be very solid. And it's this growing body of work by this panel, the scientific panel, that really provides us what we know about climate change.
The question as to whether climate change is being caused by human factors was also looked at by Dr. Benjamin Santer at the Lawrence Livermore Lab. Could you talk about his work?
Yeah, there are a couple of, and Santer's work was one of the first ones that really distinguished human-induced warming from natural warming. In other words, it's a very difficult job that these scientists had because the climate has fluctuated wildly throughout prehistory and even our own history. And so the question that was put before the UN is, what is causing this warming? Is this natural due to natural, what they call natural variability in the climate, or is this due to human causes? What Dr. Santer and a colleague, Tom Wigley, did was they essentially made some computer models that factored in all the various forces that affect the climate, and they also matched that against mappings of where the warming is taking place. And this comes from satellites and weather balloons and so forth. And they found out that the warming basically is sort of bunching up about 6-7 miles up above Earth's surface. If it were natural warming, the warming would really take place sort of evenly within the 10 miles between Earth's surface and the boundary of our inner atmosphere. And they noted where the warming was taking place, over land, over water, in which ways. And the computer model's findings sort of snapped into agreement with the physical findings. And they said at that point that this is absolutely due to our burning of fossil fuels into a couple of other greenhouse gases that we're emitting as well. So that was a very important finding. And it sort of established the fact that this is a human-caused problem. There's a much more simple-to-understand experiment that I'd like to mention very briefly. This was done by a scientist named David Easterling at the National Climatic Data Center. And Easterling essentially found that as the planet's temperature is going up, the nighttime temperatures all over the world are going up about twice as fast as the daytime temperatures. The nighttime lows are rising about twice as fast as the daytime highs. And that's because these greenhouse gases are trapping the heat in overnight, and they're preventing the normal cooling. And if it were natural warming, we would sort of see the highs and lows rise and fall in parallel. So Easterling's is one of many other studies that sort of confirmed from a different angle the findings of Ben Santer and Tom Wigley about this is due to human activities.
The speed of the change was also outlined in some research by Michael Mann, Raymond Bradley, and Malcolm Hughes, published in the Geophysical Research Letters. Are you familiar with that analysis of
very
tree rings
so.
And ice
yes,
cores?
Yes, I have their graph on my website, yeah.
Could you talk about that?
It's very interesting. Mann, Bradley, and Hughes set out to basically reconstruct the progress of the global climate, first over the past 600 years and then in a more extensive study over the past 1,000 years. So for the first 100 or so years going back, they did have thermometer records, and they had fairly reliable records of temperature. And then going back beyond that, they looked at what are called proxies, other kinds of indicators of temperature, which included things like tree rings, ice cores, because the ice core sediments have little bubbles in which it freezes the atmosphere from those times, so you can see what the composition and the temperature of the atmosphere was. They looked at the coral reefs, which also have contained sort of histories of the ocean changes. So they looked at a bunch of these other indicators that went back before we began to keep reliable weather records. And what they found was that from the year 1000 until about 1850 or 1870, the planet's temperature was very stable, and it actually, over the 1,000-year period, had decreased ever so slightly by something like 0.4 of a degree. It was a very slight cooling. But coinciding with the late 1800s, it begins to shoot upward at a very, very rapid rate. And that coincides with the industrialization of U.S. and Europe when we began to burn all these fossil fuels and move into a mass production kind of economy. So their graph that came out has been labeled a hockey stick graph because you have a very gradual decline for the long handle of the graph. And then when you hit this period in the late 19th century, it shoots upward at a startling rate. And one thing that's really interesting is, as they were plotting this graph, they sort of put down the highs and lows of temperatures from each year or each decade over the last 1,000 years. And so those highs and lows were sort of the range within the climate, within which the climate fluctuated. And then, again, from the late 19th century, it shoots upward at a rate that's way faster and way transcends any of the highs that we've seen over the last 1,000 years. And that again shows that it's not within the range of natural variability, that it very much corresponds exactly to our increased use of fossil fuels.
Now, you mentioned that there are some naysayers regarding the connection between human activity and global warming. Could you talk about some of the organizations such as Competitive Enterprise Institute and Center for the Study of CO2, which have taken a negative position on the issue?
I can, and it's interesting. I must tell you, the reason I got into this subject is, as you mentioned in the introduction, I've been a journalist all my life. I spent years at the Philadelphia Bulletin and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe. And the reason I got into this was that I found that the coal industry was secretly paying several people to say this isn't happening and also buying them huge amounts of airtime to amplify their message. And so to step back and understand where these naysayers come from, most of them, not all of them, but where the most influential of them come from, you have to look at what the implications are. And if we need to cut our emissions globally by 70%, that threatens the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in history. The oil and coal industries today do more than $1 trillion a year in commerce. And if we really were to switch away from oil and coal to other forms of energy, that would essentially turn that whole industry into a little boutique business. And so in order to counteract the findings of the United Nations and more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries, the fossil fuel lobby began paying some of these scientists under the table to say this isn't happening. And that's really where I, as a reporter, got involved in this. And again, it's not because I love nature or the trees. It's because I very strongly believe that in a democracy, we need honest information on which to base our decisions, and then we'll sort of muddle forward. So basically what happened was it was the coal industry that took the lead in this disinformation campaign going back to about 1991, about 3 years after the UN set up this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in particular, there was an association called the Western Fuels Coal Association, and they launched a very big public relations campaign. They were very candid, I must say, in their annual report, I think back in 92 or 93, in which they said they were enlisting several scientists who were skeptical about climate change. This includes Fred Singer and Pat Michaels and Robert Balling, and there have been several others. And what I found out was that they were paying these scientists. They paid them, about $1 million in a three-year period. And more important, they started a public relations campaign to send these scientists around the country to do a lot of media interviews and lectures and presentations and so forth. And we got a copy of the strategy papers for that campaign. And it said very specifically the purpose of the campaign was, and I'm quoting here, to reposition global warming as theory rather than fact. And even more specifically, the campaign was designed to target older, less educated men and young, low-income women in districts that got their electricity from coal and preferably districts that had a member on the Congressional Energy Committees. So there was nothing very subtle about this. The coal industry sort of promoted this campaign, and as I say, that's what got me into this coal subject, promoted this campaign, and then it was picked up later on in the mid-90s by the oil industry, and in particular by ExxonMobil, who is now the largest funder of these skeptics in their institutions. And again, ExxonMobil has been steadfast in its denial about human-induced climate change, and as a result, they have put a whole lot of money and effort into these naysayers to keep it basically off the public radar screen.
At this point, is the debate over, or are they continuing to this day to
They're continuing to this day, and what's very interesting is certainly there's no debate in the scientific community. I think it's very helpful to step back and look at other countries. So, for example, Holland is right now in the middle of a plan to cut her emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed the UK to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to cuts of 50% in 50 years. And about a few months ago, French President Chirac called on the entire industrial world to cut emissions by 75% by the year 2050. So there's certainly no debate in the rest of the world about what's going on. What's really important to understand, and the reason they keep this going, is the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil just want this framed as a debate. They don't care who wins the debate, as long as it's cast as a debate. Because that means the public can sort of avoid looking at this very looming and potentially very frightening and threatening prospect and walk away from it and say, come back and tell us what you know when you really know what you're talking about. So it's in their interest to keep this whole issue cast as a debate, even though there's no debate in Europe and many other countries, certainly not in the scientific community, because it allows them to continue to drill and sell oil and coal and keep their industries afloat, essentially.
Well, Mr. Gelbspan, let's take a look at what will happen to the planet if we continue to increase our CO2 emissions. For example, it seems that there is a significantly greater effect on the North and South Pole. Why is that, and what effects does global global warming have on the poles?
Climate change and global warming really has, you're right, it has a much, it's much more pronounced at the poles, and as you get closer to the equator, the impacts are less and less. And that's because the equatorial regions, and even to a lesser extent, the temperate regions, which are a little bit outside the equatorial regions, they're used to warmer temperatures. But what you see in the poles, where they're used to much colder temperatures, is an extremely dramatic meltdown taking place. One scientist I know went to the North Pole a couple of years ago, and there was basically a mile-wide lake up there when he was up there. One thing we're seeing, for example, is that the biggest glacier on the planet, which is the Greenland ice sheet, is melting at an unprecedented rate, so that between 1990 and 1995, the Greenland ice sheet was losing 3 cubic miles of ice each year. And to put that in context, that's basically enough to cover the state of Maryland with ice a foot thick. Since 1995, the rate of melting has doubled. So you're seeing a rapid decline in the world's ice cover. And on a physical basis, that really is sort of a double whammy in terms of warming. Because one property of ice is that it reflects the sunlight back into space. So the ice cover at the poles has actually acted as a sort of an offset. It's reflected ice back into space. It's reflected warmth back into space. But as the ice melts and it leaves either open surfaces of land or open surfaces of ocean, those surfaces absorb the heat. So not only are we not reflecting some of the heat back, we're actually absorbing it. So it's almost a double consequence that's happening because of the melting that's taking place.
Is this what's been called the feedback loop?
That's one of the feedback loops, for sure. And let me just finish on this question about the poles. One of the most dramatic things we're seeing is in the South Pole, where the ice shelf, the Antarctic ice shelves, have been breaking off. And since 1995, three pieces larger than the state of Rhode Island have basically broken off. And scientists are very concerned because these ice shelves, there's a difference between ice sheets and ice shelves. Ice shelves rest on the water, basically. Ice sheets rest on the land. As these ice shelves break up, they're not going to increase sea levels because they're already floating. But these ice shelves have been holding back a lot of the ice sheets that are on the land surface of Antarctica. And as the shelves break off, it means the ice sheet, the land-based ice sheet, is beginning to flow into the oceans, and that can raise sea levels dramatically. It can cause coastal flooding all over the world. So that's one big concern of scientists.
Another phenomenon of the North is the Arctic permafrost and the effect that global warming is having on that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Here's where you get into your question of feedbacks. And basically what feedbacks mean is what scientists use the term feedback to refer to very small changes in certain planetary systems that trigger very big changes in other systems. So, for example, the permafrost in Alaska is melting, and that means that the land is becoming softer. It actually means that pipeline braces are sinking and pipelines are leaking and breaking because the ground underneath them is no longer stable. But one very important thing that the tundra has done, and the tundra in northern Canada and large areas of it in Siberia, this tundra has frozen a lot of carbon dioxide and methane. And methane is also a very potent heat-trapping gas. And as the tundra is melting, it's beginning to thaw and release these gases back into the atmosphere, and that could trigger another whole spike in heating. So that's an example of what you're asking about when you ask about feedbacks, and that's something that has the scientists very, very concerned.
Another area is the weather systems. In 2003, 50,000 Europeans died in a summer heat wave. Is this an indication of what global warming might hold for us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting. One of the first sort of earmarks of early stage global warming is much more extreme weather. So, for example, we get more extended heat waves, more frequent heat waves, more extended droughts. We get much more torrential downpours. Instead of the more traditional even rainfalls, we get much more of our rain in these intense, severe kind of flash flood downpours. And we also have much more intense storms. And just to talk about what basically warming does is it sort of forces the planet's whole hydrological cycle. So, for example, as the atmosphere warms, it accelerates the rate at which the water evaporates, the surface water evaporates. It also expands the air to hold more water. So when the normal turbulence comes through, we get much more of these intense, severe downpours. The warming that takes place over certain regions also makes for much sharper fronts between various weather fronts. So you and that creates very big winds. When you have very cold areas next to very warm areas, you have much stronger winds. One area in which this is very visible is the fact that as it warms the surface waters of the oceans, it intensifies the ferocity of hurricanes. So, for example, if we think back to Katrina, Katrina started as a normal, I think, Category 1 hurricane that glanced off South Florida. I think it had winds of something like 70 miles an hour. But then it moved over the superheated waters of the Gulf of Mexico, where the temperatures were in the high 80s, and it swelled into this enormous megastorm and created all the horrendous destruction that we saw in the Gulf Coast and New Orleans. So just real briefly, I'll give you from last year, from 2005. At the beginning of the year, they had a 2-foot snowfall right outside Los Angeles. In February, they had a 224-mile-an-hour windstorm in Scandinavia that required them to shut down their nuclear plants. That same summer, there was a severe drought in the Midwest that dropped water levels in the Missouri River to their lowest on record. In July, they had the worst drought on record in southern Europe that triggered extensive wildfires in Spain and Portugal. There was a lethal heat wave that same summer in Arizona that kept temperatures above 110 for a week. It killed more than 20 people. In August, the Indian city of Mumbai received 37 inches of rain in one day, and this disrupted the lives of 20 million people. And then, of course, days later, we had Katrina. So that's an example of the kind of extreme weather events that the scientists have projected and that are now coming home in reality.
Another aspect that I've heard about is the effect, possible effect on the Gulf Stream. Could you talk about that?
That's a very frightening kind of effect, and it was sort of caricatured a little bit in the movie The Day After Tomorrow. And basically, the theory of this, and this has been a big concern of scientists, is this, that in the reason that the areas of northern Europe and northern North America are habitable is because you have warm waters from the equatorial regions that flow in these large currents that flow up. And in this case, what's called the Gulf Stream, it flows up the coast of North America, crosses below Greenland, it flows down the coast of Western Europe. And that really is what gives Britain, for example, northern Europe, northern Canada, and New England, where I live, that's what gives us fairly temperate kind of weather. What the scientists are very concerned about is a repeat of something that happened about 10,000 years ago, in which there was a sudden change in these currents, and a rapid deep freeze sort of descended over the northern hemisphere. And the reason that happened is this. What keeps this Gulf Stream moving in its course is the fact that the water up in off Greenland, up in the North Atlantic, is extremely salty and it's very dense, and the surface water sort of naturally falls to the bottom. And as it falls, it pulls this Gulf Stream forward. It's sort of like a natural pump. And as we get more melt from the ice up in the Arctic, that dilutes that water. Much more fresh water comes in. And what happened about 10,000 years ago was there was a big rapid ice melt. There was a huge infusion of fresh water into this North Atlantic pump area. And the Gulf Stream sort of went, it didn't shut down, but it sort of went due east, like from New York across to Spain. And there was this very rapid deep freeze that descended over the Northern Hemisphere, especially in Europe and North America. And essentially, the whole area was covered by ice. And what amazes scientists who have looked at ice cores from that period is that that whole change took about 4 or 5 years. It happened in a very, very rapid fashion. So that's another concern about scientists. And that event. That's called a rapid climate change event. And they're concerned about it. The problem is we simply don't know where we are along the spectrum of rapid climate change events because there are invisible thresholds that get crossed that we don't know about it. So we really focus much more on the kind of incremental changes that we can see and we can project, like what's happening to the vegetation and so forth.
There's vegetation in the ocean as well. And how has that been affected by the climate change?
It's interesting. There has been, because of warming waters, a big growth of all kinds of algae, for example, and a lot of that is toxic algae, so it's not necessarily good. But there are very troubling stories out, findings out, and one was out very, very recently, and this is essentially about a big decline in ocean plankton. And as the oceans warm, they're several different stories about what it does, and I'll go through them briefly. People noticed a couple of years ago that there was a big die-off of seabirds in the Pacific Northwest off the coast of Vancouver and Washington State and northern Canada there, and they began to find out why this happened. They asked why this happened, and it turns out there was a small change in ocean temperature, and that meant that the kind of plankton that had survived under the previous temperature sort of died out, and a new kind of plankton took its place. But the fish that lived off the old kind of plankton couldn't eat the new kind of plankton, so they began to disappear. And as a result of their disappearance, the seabirds that feasted on the fish have also died out. So a small temperature change in that case was changing the composition of a tiny marine organisms that resulted in very large changes. The more recent findings that I've seen are that the plankton themselves are dying off and the oceans are becoming much less productive, and so they have found declines of up to 50% of plankton production, phytoplankton production in parts of the Pacific, and that is very, very troubling in terms of the whole health of the marine ecosystems, basically.
I've read that there's been a basically collapse in the ecosystem of the North Sea.
That's right, and it's again from the same phenomenon that we're talking about. And as if this news isn't bad enough, there's one other phenomenon that's kicking in that's not directly a consequence of global warming, but it is a consequence of all the coal and oil that we're burning. And that's that the oceans are becoming much more acid. So that as the fallout from our burning of carbon fuels gets into the ocean, the ocean's acidity, its pH level of the oceans, have changed more in the last 100 years than they did in the previous 10,000. And that is likely to kill off lots of coral reefs, which are really sort of sources of life. They're like the Amazon rainforest of the ocean, and they generate all kinds of marine life and so forth. So you have not only the warming affecting the oceans, but you also have this progressive acidification, and that even troubles some scientists more than the warming does.
There's another different area of climate change that we should discuss, and that's diseases.
Right.
What impact will climate change have on the spread of disease?
It's interesting. It absolutely, the most obvious impact comes from heating itself. And you mentioned at the top of the show the heat wave that killed anywhere from 35 to 50,000 people in Europe. And part of that, again, is because of what I mentioned about the nighttime lows going up twice as fast as the daytime highs. So that when, I'm sure there have been heat waves in the past that were just as long and just as hot as the heat wave we saw in Europe two summers ago. But what happens now with this greenhouse warming that traps the heat in overnight is that when a person's body becomes heat stressed during the daytime, they don't have the normal nighttime cooling that allows them to recuperate. And that, I think, is a big reason why we saw so many fatalities in Europe. In terms of human health, there's another whole aspect to that, and that's this. Of all the systems of nature, one of the most sensitive to temperature change is insects. And as the planet warms, we're seeing a huge increase in the population of crop-destroying and disease-spreading insects. So, for example, mosquitoes that could only live up to 1,800 meters are now being found at 3,200 meters up mountainsides. They're seeing mosquitoes up in the North Pole, which they've never seen before. And as a result, we are seeing mosquitoes spread malaria and dengue fever and yellow fever to populations that have never before been exposed to these diseases, and have no natural immunity. So you're seeing it both on the insect level, you're seeing it on the level of heat itself, and you're also going to be seeing it in terms of crop failures and nutrition-related illnesses as well.
So far we've been talking about in a global way. Can we bring this closer to home to talk perhaps about the coast of New England, where many of our listeners live? What sort of impact might they see?
The first one that we're already beginning to see, but that will become much more pronounced, is sea level rise. And as seas rise, they will put more and more coastal cities in danger of flooding. When there are storm surges, these surges will go farther inland. Eventually, of course, the IPCC, the scientific panel, projects that sea levels can rise as much as 30 feet over this century, and that would clearly put a lot of us underwater. I mean, I live in Boston, and I'm about 2 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean, and I can see my backyard is becoming beachfront property. So that's one consequence that we can see in New England. We're seeing a real impact on the maple syrup trees up in New Hampshire and Vermont already from warming wintertime temperatures. But I must say, I don't think it's totally productive to think of it in terms of our own geographical region, because our world today is so interconnected that impacts that happen in other parts of the world will affect us big time. And I'm talking about job loss. I'm talking about political upheaval. I'm talking about the flight of environmental refugees. And so while it's interesting to look at what the consequences for New England will be, I think there are a whole lot of consequences that will be affecting many parts of the globe that will affect our political stability, our economic well-being, in ways that we're not quite prepared for.
Some of the scientists talk about a tipping point, a point at which a change becomes almost unstoppable. Where do you think we are? Where do the scientists say that we are in relationship to tipping point?
It's interesting. There were three such discussions out in the last year or so. Dr. Pachauri, who is head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said that he felt we were about a decade away from a point of no return. And he issued a very strong statement. He said, we need to make very, very deep cuts in our carbon fuel use, quote, if humanity is to survive. That is extraordinarily strong language for a UN diplomat to be using. Jim Hansen, who's one of the premier climate scientists in the United States and who works for NASA, has basically said we have about a 10-year period before we hit this point of no return, in which you start seeing self-perpetuating runaway climate changes. And a very prominent British scientist named James Lovelock said we've already passed this point of no return. So the real truth, I think, is we don't know. But the point is we're very, very close to the point of some of these runaway planetary systems changes. And my personal feeling is, given the resistance to the kind of institutional changes we need to make, we probably are either at or beyond the point of no return. In other words, what's very clear is what we need to do is rewire the world with clean energy. And the technologies exist. We can get all the energy we need from wind and solar and biofuels and hydrogen and so forth. But you have this enormous resistance from the coal and oil industries. And if I step back and sort of weigh the state of the planet and the pace of environmental change against what I know as a journalist is the inertia of institutional change, especially when you have huge interests militating against those changes, we very well could be past that point.
Where does the goal of 70%, how does that compare to the Kyoto process, what its goals are?
The Kyoto process was much less. The Kyoto Treaty basically called for the industrial countries to cut their emissions anywhere from 5 to 8%, depending on which country you're talking about, by the year 2012, I think. And in the face of the fact that the climate has begun to change much more quickly than the scientific community had anticipated, the delegates to Kyoto wanted to go back and ramp up those goals dramatically so that they would be much more in keeping with what nature requires. Their original plan was, let's start at 5 or 6 or 7%, and then incrementally we will be able to draw down our emissions from that point. But the world around us is changing too quickly, so they really were prepared to go back and come out with much, much stronger, higher goals and much shorter timetables for this. And unfortunately, politically, America has been very obstructionist in this process, and it sort of prevented that from happening.
So the Bush administration does not participate in the Kyoto process?
President Bush withdrew us from the Kyoto process in 2001. And I have to tell you, from my own perspective, and it's a sort of slimy one, being an investigative reporter, what I really see is basically that big coal and big oil are sort of writing the climate and energy policies for the Bush administration. And in fact, after Bush withdrew the U.S. from the Kyoto process, the White House sent several notes to ExxonMobil thanking them for their active involvement in helping shape administration policies. So, for example, at last year's IPCC meeting, the delegates were all ready to really come out with much, much higher goals and much shorter timetables to propel this energy transition. And the United States, even though it was not a part of the Kyoto process, it still is a signatory to the Rio Treaty. This gets very involved in terms of diplomatic legalisms, and I don't want to spend that time on it. But basically, they had leverage through their participation in the Rio Treaty to determine the terms of that next round of climate negotiations, and they were able to enforce the fact that no action plan at all would be allowed, only informational seminars. So all these delegates met in Bonn. They were prepared to come out with much stronger measures, and the Bush administration said, nope, you can only have informational seminars. And as a result, the head of the climate negotiations said that the U.S. essentially left the climate talks hanging onto a rock face by their fingernails. So what you really see here, from my point of view, is the fact that our political process is corrupted by money, and that is really having a huge impact on the fate of the world, you know? And this is something we're accustomed to. It's something that I've covered as a journalist for years. But in the past, that kind of corruption in the political process has had much smaller consequences.
The stakes are very high here.
The stakes are really high. So in the past, they've resulted in some defective products or some looted pension funds. Here we're talking about the fate of humanity, and that's a much, much bigger set of stakes, as
you say. To put this in perspective, over how many years is the 70% reduction supposed to be achieved?
Originally, the IPCC said it should be achieved by 2100. Now they're saying by 2050.
And currently, say last year versus this year, has there been a reduction or an increase in
CO2? No, there's been an increase in emissions.
So we haven't even started on the downward.
No, and they've tried a little bit in Europe. But again, even these countries that have pledged 60 and 70 and 80 and 50% reductions, they can't go it alone. If they really go too far as individual countries, they're going to put themselves at a real competitive disadvantage. This has to happen with the whole world acting in concert, doing it in lockstep.
Well, in this regard, you have outlined a plan that's published on your site, a three-part plan to address the global warming crisis. Could you talk about that plan?
I'd be happy to, because it's really where I've been spending most of my energy in trying to promote this. And we've gotten some wonderful reactions from people in Europe and developing countries and so forth. And I think it's really important to understand one thing before I go into the details of the plan. Developing countries would love to go solar and clean energy. The most air-polluted cities in the world are in China and Bangkok, Thailand, and Mexico City and Santiago, Chile. They would love to go clean energy. They just can't afford it. So the plan involves three mechanisms. The first one involves a way for industrial countries to change. The second creates a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries. And then the third is a regulatory mechanism that would make it all work. So that in the industrial world, right now the United States spends more than $25 billion a year subsidizing coal and oil. Those subsidies in the industrial world overall come out to about $200 billion a year. And we're saying in the industrial countries, take those subsidies away from coal and oil, put them behind renewables, and a couple of things will happen. First of all, the oil companies will follow the subsidies. They will become aggressive developers of solar panels and windmills and, you know, turbines and tidal devices and so forth. And also, if you move those subsidies into renewables, you will see all these energy engineers coming out of the woodwork with successively better generations of solar film and turbine devices. I think you would see an explosion of creativity in the energy field that would rival the dot-com revolution of the 90s. In terms of the developing countries, as I said, they'd all love to go solar. The real issue is affordability. So what we need is a large fund, and a Blue Ribbon Energy think tank has calculated this fund to be about $300 billion a year for a decade to really embed renewable energy infrastructures in developing countries. So you can get this money from a number of sources. You can get it from carbon taxes in the north. A former British cabinet minister proposed a small tax on international air travel. One mechanism we like is a tax on international currency transactions, and that means you have speculators who play the yen against the euro, against the dollar, or just in the normal course of international commerce, there are these currency conversions. And today, these currency transactions total about $1.5 trillion every day. And we're proposing that they be taxed at the rate of a quarter of a penny on a dollar, and that would net out to this $300 billion a year. Basically, what we're talking about is a small tax on global commerce to preserve the global environment.
And the fund would be used for?
And the fund would be used specifically for windmills in South Africa and solar assemblies in El Salvador and fuel cell factories in India and so forth. And the other reason we like it is that it would bring the banks into the game. You wouldn't need much by way of bureaucracy because all these currency transactions are electronically monitored by the banks. And we would ask the banks to administer this money for a small fee. It would be a huge safeguard against corruption in developing countries. And so, for example, if India were to get, I'm just making this up, of course, but if India were to get $10 billion out of this year's pie, the banks would release the money to India. They would release it as certain benchmarks were met and clean energy facilities were established. And I think it would be a very clean way to do it without having much of a bureaucracy set up.
The developing countries such as China and India do have a gripe in that they can say, look, the West is already industrialized. They're responsible for the fossil fuel pollution. You know, why should we have to suppress our industry in order to accommodate targets?
Well, they will say that, and they'll say, we're not going to start first until, you know, you and the U.S. and Europe go forward. But because their air quality is so bad, because there's so much acid rain and lung disease and other consequences of air pollution, they really would like to make this transition. And I think if we were to provide this fund by a small tax on global commerce that would provide them these clean energy sources, they would snap it up. And there's one other reason why I know they would come along, and this comes from a former executive director of the World Bank, and he made the point in lots of his writings and lots of his work that every dollar you invest in energy in a developing country creates way more jobs and way more wealth than the same dollar invested in any other sector. So were we, for example, to help to finance the transfer of clean energy in the interior of Asia and Africa, it would lead to a lot of startup businesses. It would lead to the growth of indigenous industries. I think it would begin to turn poor countries into trading partners. I think it would expand the overall wealth in the global economy. And that's really what's in it for developing countries.
So you have a subsidy switch from fossil fuels to renewables, and an energy fund to promote a renewable energy production. What's the third part of this?
The third part of it was suggested by a gentleman named Tom Kasten, who is a utility company president here in the U.S. And Tom suggested a very neat mechanism, which is a progressive fossil fuel efficiency standard that goes up by 5% a year. And that would involve all the countries of the world. And the way it would work very simply is every country would start at its own baseline right now to increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% each year. That means a country would produce the same amount next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or it would produce 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows at 5% for very long, emissions reductions would outpace long-term economic growth. And it would actually happen much more quickly than that, because for the first, few years, 5 to 10 years, companies would meet that 5% just by efficiencies, just by getting the waste out of their current energy systems. And then when those efficiencies got used up, they would meet this 5% by using more and more renewable technologies. And that would begin to make the mass markets and economies of scale that would bring down their prices and make them actually cheaper than coal and oil. So we're saying those three strategies together, changing the subsidies in the industrial countries, creating this fund for developing countries, and having them all adhere to this progressive efficiency standard, which could work very well within the Kyoto framework, is a way to accomplish this transition very quickly.
What do you think it's going to take to get our political leaders and the American people generally to focus on the urgency of global warming?
Boy, that's a very difficult question, Ken. I'm not sure. I do know that I sense a real sea change in people's attitudes over about the last year and a half, 2 years. People are really freaked out about the weather. They know something's wrong, and they know something needs to be done about it. I had a very interesting meeting with some, talk with some farmers. This was a radio program. I did a call-in show, and they were saying, gee, you know, the soil is drying out too quickly. The birds are laying their eggs at the wrong time. The plants are blooming out of whack. And they were actually very grateful to know there was a reason for this. It sort of validated their hands-on experience. So I think what's necessary is to mobilize the public is to show them that there's a very positive future that can come out of this, not just a defensive one. I think it's also really important to tie this in with issues that do concern people. In this case, I'm talking about security issues. And there's no question that were we to provide clean energy in poor countries, that would undermine the kind of economic desperation that gives rise to a lot of terrorism, a lot of anti-U.S. sentiment. It really would turn, as I mentioned before, poor countries into trading partners. It would expand the global economy. And I think people need to see the positive benefits of this instead of just the scary, you know, aspects of not acting. And then I think you need basically a clean government that's able to make its decisions without being influenced by the industries that are being affected here. I think that's extremely important.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very, very much for being with us, Mr. Gelbspan. We've been talking to Ross Gelbspan, author of The Heat Is On and Boiling Point, and you can visit his website, heatisonline.org. Thanks again very much.